May I have your attention, please?
Your attention, please?
Good afternoon and welcome to Attention, Please. KPTZ airs Attention, Please twice each Monday at noon and at 5 and on Saturdays at noon in order to draw the attention of all of us to the good work being done to build a better, informed, and more resilient community. I'm Phil Andrus. With me are Artists in Wood, Annalise Rubita and Seth Rowland. Their work currently is on exhibit in the Jefferson Museum of Art and History, and Ann Welch, Vice President of the Historical Society, Board of Directors, Chair of the Art Advisory Committee, co-curator of Wood. That's an exhibit. We'll talk about that. That is the subject, actually. And producer of the impressive exhibit catalog, which I have and have really enjoyed having at home. The text was written by Jenny Westall, by the way, and most of the photographs are by Anne. With me, too, is Shelley Levins, Executive Director of the Jefferson County Historical Society. Greetings and welcome to each and every one of you.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for having us.
Shelley, whose idea was it for the Society to celebrate wood and woodworkers?
Wow. So this has been tossed around, I think, for several years now. But I think it was generated within our Art Advisory Committee as a topic of interest. And here we are.
Wood in so many ways is and always has been important to this community. Before the Europeans settled, of course, there were Native American canoes made out of cedar wood. Ann Welch, you curated the show. Now, that's a term that I'm hearing more and sometimes even in context of music. But I want to know from you what it means to you to curate a show like this and how much time is taken of your life to do so.
Well, it takes quite a bit of time, but it's really a group project. This one was certainly put together with, it was actually originally my co-curator's idea, Laura Reuter, who wanted to do, has more of a background in wood than I do, who had wanted to do this show for some time. And because we're a historical museum, we also wanted to take kind of a longer view at the subject. So we got together with Heron Scott from the Woodworking School and Tim Lawson from the Splinter Group to talk about people that we could include in the exhibit. And then, of course, we have Jenny Westall, who's a fabulous writer, who put all of this together in an art catalog, which is available for purchase at the museum, that helps fund all of our programs, essays about each one of the artists. While curating, we got to spend time in the studios of at least the contemporary artists that we're using in the show. And so what we really set out to do was to, you know, look at kind of a long history of wood. And we were happily gifted this wonderful cross-section of a 1,000-year-old cedar tree from Drew and Pamela Elliker, which sort of, from my mind, sets everything that we need to know about wood in a way. It's a huge thing, but it took 1,000 years to grow that tree. And that sort of sets out that preciousness and the connection of that material to our area. And then when we walk into the museum, you also get to see Brian Perry, who's from the Port Gamble Sklallam tribe. His work, steeped in the tradition, is also has this contemporary work that he has brought to it, which is, he's an extraordinary artist and is now working actually larger in a lot of pieces down in Port Gamble. So he was an obvious place to start this exhibit in. And then years ago, we were gifted Horace Tucker's tools. Now, Horace Tucker was one of the guys that built a whole lot of the buildings and houses in Port Townsend, from the Pink House to the Rothschild House. We just have one of his toolboxes chests in the museum. And there are actually two of them. I think of them as a panel van of yore, where all of the materials he needed to use to build houses was put into these. He'd set them up and then build this house. Beautiful planes and the tools that, you know, that one would need. So then we have to start to look at our more contemporary artists from our community. We can kind of look at Steve Habersetzer, who has worked in wood in sort of every different way you can for almost his entire life, from cutting down trees to working on boats to making cabinets, who's now sort of returning to more traditional ways, using more hand tools. He, you know, won't use sheet goods anymore, and he mostly uses all sorts of responsibly harvested Northwest woods.
What I was wondering, you have been involved in the Historical Society for quite a long while, I believe. Is that correct?
That would be true.
Okay. And my observation of the museum, that's how I see the Historical Society most, and these recordings that we do for broadcast, is it has evolved a bit from history and art to art and history. The emphasis these days seems to be, I think, my observation, more strongly on art than history. I'm wondering what you think of that. You are a professional photographer and videographer, so art is your work. But sometimes I wonder about, I ask you this as a board member, you are the board member, is what do you think of this transition? Do you think I'm observing it correctly? And if so, what's your observation about it?
I think we kind of treat them equally. Right now, we're just starting a campaign to really, really focus on our history exhibit. And so we're not at all choosing one over the other. And they're both intricately, you know, combined. I don't think you make that separation from those two things. Art's always been a huge part of our community. Now, I'm going to disagree with you. And I think you're going to really see in the next year or two how important that, you know, I guess they would call the nuts and bolts of history is to our organization.
Annalise Rubita, I have written, I'm thinking it takes a seaside village and a degree in geology to raise a woodworker. First, and I'm not talking about family firewood, I'm talking about wood that you're going to make something beautiful out of. When did you first put your hand to wood? Or hands, both of them, I suppose.
Yeah, I definitely use both hands. Makes it a lot easier. I hadn't done any functional woodworking until I started at the woodworking school. I grew up at North Beach. Well, I grew up off of Inchimacum, and then my family moved to North Beach. And I went to Peninsula College, and so I would walk by the woodworking school every day, walking through the fort. And there was always crazy stuff going on there. People were out there, like, hacking into wood with, like, huge saws, and, like, they were frozen, looked insane and super fun. And so I always wanted to go. And my dad was a cabinet maker growing up, so that fueled that as well. And then I finally got to the chance to go after I worked a summer in Alaska and had some savings and spent it all on that first course. And that was the first time 2.5 years ago that I actually got to make something.
So your mentors have been folks in the boat school, but I would imagine people outside the boat school as well, and for that matter, including the faculty there. I'm wondering who have made the most strong impression upon you, helped you develop your interest in what you would do with wood and your styles for working with wood?
Well, I am not involved with the boat school, but the woodworking school.
Did I say boat school? I meant woodworking school, sorry.
The great thing about working at the woodworking school is we get tons of amazing visiting instructors, and I think they've all had a really big impact in the work I do now and the learning opportunities I've had up to this point. Steve Habesetzer, who's also in the show, was the first person to ever teach me about chairs and has informed a lot of my knowledge. Also, right now, I'm working in Seth's shop part-time, so I think we're both learning together there, me the most. I mean, honestly, just this community, it's you'd be hard-pressed not to learn about wood and boats and, to Anne's point, history living here. It's so cultivated and wonderful.
How about socializing among woodworkers, people that you work with? I'm thinking of, because I worked in the marine trades, that was maybe my group for just hanging out and after work hours and so forth. Are there places that woodworkers gather around here that you may gather with them?
I really value the community at the woodworking school. It's a huge part of why that job feels so sustainable to me and like something that I want to pour a lot of my time and energy into. We definitely go to the poorhouse quite a bit, I would say, and recently have been getting very into woodworking Pictionary. I don't know whose idea it was, but it's gotten very competitive lately and moderately stressful.
You've developed your woodworking skills and maybe the beginning of your career during a time when, whether we liked it or not, we were forced to be somewhat solitary. I'm wondering if that has had an influence upon you, maybe even has influenced your career choice.
When I started at the woodworking school as a student, it was the last 2 weeks that COVID shut down. So it right at the end of my first 3 months woodworking, I was taking the Foundations of Woodworking Intensive. COVID, from my perspective, started. the school closed for, this could be a little bit inaccurate, but I'd say maybe about a month or so, but has largely been able to remain open and functioning. And I started TAing and sharpening tools and whatnot shortly after that. I mean, I was lucky enough to keep working in person, depending on if you like that or not. And it was hugely influential in my, just those were like the only people I saw because everybody was on lockdown. It's been incredible to start this new career during a pandemic, and it's been challenging for lots of different reasons, but I think it also gave me a lot of time alone in my shop when I literally couldn't go and do anything.
Something which seems to be a rising area of interest is brooms. And I tend to think of brooms as the dirty work of the world, doing the dirty work of the world, and nothing that one would think to lavish one's artistic impulse upon. The Attention Please before the one currently being broadcast was of Joanne Pontrello and some other folks from Saltwater Seeds, and they are growing grass for brooms. Suddenly, brooms are more than they used to be, and you are making brooms. What's your observation about this? I mean, when you make a broom and maybe somebody buys it from you, do you say, use this for anything as long as you don't let it touch the floor?
Well, first, I want to credit the brooms that I've made were largely inspired by Aspen Golan, who is a visiting instructor we're going to be having at the school. And she actually published a little Instagram how-to on making brooms that is on her Instagram, that anybody who's interested in making brooms, I would highly recommend they go check out. It's extremely accessible and really fun. And I use all the brooms I made actually before I put them in the museum. I had to clean them up quite a bit because they were really, really dirty. And I mean, I love making things that are functional and usable. And I think making a broom you couldn't use would be a bit of a bummer because you spend so much time on it.
Well, I guess I would think of a broom as something that I would buy at Henry Hardware and take yours and put it up on my wall to admire it. But I have one more question for you, and that is, and you're the young person of this set, so maybe it's not a fair question to ask someone of your age, but the question is, do you see this seemingly beginning of a career in woodworking merely an episode in your life, or do you think this will take you to your later years? Is this a passion that will last forever?
Well, I guess that depends on if I keep making enough money doing it, but I hope so. I truly love it. It's all my life I've been doing small things with my hands, and it's hugely important to me. And woodworking feels like a culmination of a lifetime of messing around, and I love every part of it. I love the community, and I really, really appreciate the inspiration I get from the people I work with. And being involved with the school is such an amazing way to continue that inspiration constantly. You'd be hard-pressed not to be inspired by all the amazing people that come through there.
I want to move to Seth Rowland. Seth Rowland, I looked at some of your work, and you're a magician. I mean, I don't see how you can make some of those things that you make. The pieces with thin strips of wood made out of solid pieces of wood without gluing them together, that is, I would say, I can't imagine how you do it. And it is a good reason for folks to go to the museum and see what you have done. And you've had solo exhibits elsewhere. And this is not solo, of course. This is with other people. But Bellevue Arts Museum, several galleries around the East Coast, you pretty much have made it, it seems like. When did you know you had?
I started making a living, making furniture very early on. I started off making patio chairs in New Mexico. So I've been supporting myself by doing this for 30 years now. And in my mind, I guess being able to make a living doing it is making it. So that happened pretty early on. It felt very lucky and kind of magical at the beginning. And then it's gotten a lot easier since then. It took more effort to figure out how to make things and how to sell them in particular. Over time, the selling part gets a lot easier because more people know of you and work comes my way with much less effort than it used to. sort of right from the get-go when I first started my business working for myself. It worked out quickly and easily.
Did you start with chairs or with 2x4s in construction lumber? I mean, many people I know who work with wood started with 2x4s in construction lumber.
Right, right. I guess my first decent woodworking was my last semester of college I spent at Mystic Seaport Museum in a program there. And one of the classes I could take was a practical one, and I took a small building course with John Gardner, who's sort of the guy who wrote the book on building small craft a long time ago. And he was 83 at the time and was just an amazing craftsman and a really entertaining guy. And then I went and worked on some tall ships in Maine, and then worked for a boat builder, and then got a job for a furniture maker, and then moved to New Mexico and started making patio chairs, which were not out of 2x4s. They were out of strips that were inch by inch and a half, but lots of repetitive pieces. And they were very simple and took very few tools. So it was kind of a production situation, but it was my own.
And then you moved to Port Townsend, and you don't work on boats.
No. I really like boats, and I like sailing in them. And there's a lot of great craftsmanship and interesting puzzles that are involved in making them. But I think maybe because of my upbringing, my mom's an architect, my dad is a landscape architect, I was always kind of interested in design. And boats have to look like boats or they don't work. Whereas a table, you just need 9 to 30 inches off the floor and you've got a dining table, and all the rest of the decisions are up to me. So there was a lot more freedom in furniture, and I liked that. For me, the woodworking was really interesting the first number of years because I was learning how to put things together and how to make things, and there was all that joy in sort of demystifying a process. But after a certain point, when I felt like I knew a fair bit about how to make things, then the focus really of my interest shifted to what am I going to make? And not how am I going to make it. That's where the furniture has allowed me a lot of freedom in deciding what I'm going to make. Whereas with boats, it's a lot more function is has a lot more constraints on the design than it does with furniture.
Since Anne disagreed with me, I'll disagree with you just a little bit. You make chairs, and there is nothing that needs to be more functional and safely functional than a chair. And your chairs are made out of fairly small pieces of wood, but they have to hold together for anybody who might sit on them. And some people are bigger and some people are smaller. What are some of the elements in making a chair? And safety comes to mind. That is safe, that will be durable, that will not collapse under a 300-pound fellow. Is it the glues? Is it in the engineering? How do you make a safe chair?
It's the strength of the wood and then the strength of the connections. You're right that there are more constraints on the design of a chair than there are on a table. But still with a chair, if you sit, when you're sitting in a chair, you're sitting on a surface that supports your thighs and your butt at a certain height and angle that's comfortable. And then there's some back support that needs to hit your lumbar and maybe up higher than that. And then if there's arms, you need some surfaces at a certain height. But when you draw those on a piece of paper, it's just a few lines. And how you connect those and what you connect them with and what those each of those parts look like are still choices you get to make.
When I saw Ghost Trees, and here we are on radio, we don't have a picture. People are going to have to either get the picture from the booklet that Anne has put together, or more likely by going to the museum. But this is a set of trees made up of, as I describe it, strips of wood that look like they would have been all ripped on the bandsaw or the table saw and that all glued together. But that is not how you've done it. You have ripped the wood somehow without taking it apart. It's a very impressive thing to do. And there's like how many trees, 3 or 4 trees in the particular piece. I wonder how long it took you to do that.
The idea took longer than probably the process. It's sort of evolved over a long time, but it's really quite simple. It's just I'm cutting the wood partly apart, but not all the way, and then steaming it, which allows you it gives it some flexibility and allows you to bend the parts into a position that then they then mostly stay into.
So you're starting with a flat board. What tool are you using to get into the board and cut material away without cutting from one end to the other?
Usually a bandsaw.
Well, I urge everybody to go and see the exhibit at the museum, and you will then understand why I find this even still hard to believe, actually. I confess, Shelley will never let me in the museum again, so this is the confession that would lead to that. I walked up to Ghost Trees, and I touched it. Then I saw the sign on the wall, and then I read in the description that was written about you that you like your pieces to be touched. And they want to be touched. I mean, there I was. I didn't rattle it or anything such as that. I just, you know, touched it a little bit and then slapped my hand. What do you think it is about your work that begs to be touched?
Well, I think wood is a really tactile material. Might have touched somebody else's piece in the show when I went to visit, but I won't necessarily admit it. And it's just a really warm, inviting material. One of the things I like about making furniture is that people are expected to touch it. If you make a sculpture, most people, even if it's their own sculpture, won't necessarily go up and touch it. But if it's a chair or a table, you sit at it every day and you're touching it. And so the edges and the textures and the forms really matter. And part of how you understand it is through your fingers.
And I did, briefly, very briefly. One last question. Woodworkers, even I, such as I am, woeful perhaps as I am, make tools because they encounter problems, puzzles that no ready-made off-the-shelf tool can address. I'm curious the tools that you make to do the work that you do.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's like when there's a problem to solve, how do you do that? And I guess if I were to give an example of my favorite one, I have a piece of wood that's sort of small and thin, maybe about the diameter of a pencil, that's kind of a little bit flexible. It's a weird piece of wood, some walnut, that if you bend it, it actually kind of stays put up to a certain point. It was kicking around for a while, and I hot glued a 1-inch pencil onto the end of it so that when I need to draw a line on something where a straight pencil won't fit, but I need a curved pencil, I can draw a line there. That's one of my favorites.
Seth Rowland, thank you for chatting with me, and thank you for the work that you do. It was, I guess I repeat myself, but pretty breathtaking. Annalise, back to you for just a moment. Tools that you have made so that you can do the work that you do.
Yeah, I have lots of weirdly specific pieces of wood and jigs and things with angles on it that look like scrap but are highly critical for gluing things together. The chair that's in the museum has the stiles in the back exposed, which is super challenging to glue up. And so I have like a whole slew of bits and pieces of wood that I have made to securely hold it in place for the 2 rounds of glue that it gets.
And thank you, Annalise. Back to Anne. I interrupted you. You did not get to Helga Winter when you were describing the artists in the show.
Helga, we have downstairs in what was once the women's jail. And that space can be kind of a really wonderfully intimate space. And Helga's work seemed to have fit best in there. It's kind of like a jewelry box. And her pieces are really that gem that fits right into that. And we thought that room showed her off to the best of our ability. Her work is quite amazing. And it's such a collaborative work because she is working with the material that she uses. After she makes it, it bends and changes and moves. Then her surface decoration is really quite extraordinary.
And now it's Shelley's turn. Shelley, The Doors. And this is not the band. We're not talking about music from the 1960s. We're talking about the front doors that were to be, I think you probably intended them to be, the new doors in place for this exhibit. But wood being what it is, and the term supply chains now has become part of our vocabulary, so there is that as well. There are going to be new doors, though, and fairly soon, I think, from what you told me. The old doors having suffered from time in facing the south wind.
Yeah, exactly. So as Anne indicated, there's a women's jail in our basement. And for some listeners who haven't visited our museum, they may not understand what that means. We're in historic City Hall, and this building was opened to the public in 1892. The doors that we are going to retire are the original doors to the building. So this happens occasionally with historic structures, that it's time for a rebuild of a piece of the building as part of restoration and its continued use. And so we're working with Seb Eggert of Rain Shadow Woodworks. He's done many, many historic restoration and preservation projects of this type in our community. And he's rebuilding the doors out of redwood for the museum and for Historic City Hall as our public entrance and the first thing that people see. Because we're south facing, our building, as many buildings in downtown Port Townsend, really take a beating from the weather. And so these hopefully will stand the test of time for another 150 years to be open to the public.
Shelley, will there be a party once the doors are installed, a celebration?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, so we hope to get the doors installed by the end of this month. And then we are throwing a party at the museum on April 2nd. And we invite anyone who is a member of our organization or a guest of a member to come and join us and celebrate the doors and these amazing woodworkers in our community and the history of our community through the eyes of wood. Please come out for that. And if you're not already a member of the Historical Society, we have lots of ways to get engaged. There's a pay what you can option for all sizes of budgets. And we invite everyone to get involved because we've got all kinds of other cool things coming up too.
Oh, one more thing, Shelley. When are you open? When do the old doors open? And then when will the new doors open? Hours of open for the museum?
Yeah, come to the museum for sure. So we're right now, our hours are Thursday through Sunday from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. If that, you know, I always love to say this because I really would never want our hours to really be a barrier for anyone to not be able to access their community museum. If our hours really don't work for you, send me a note and we'll absolutely get you in.
That is a very cool thing to hear someone say, especially the executive director of a historical society. And that is who she is. Shelley Levins, thanks for being with me. Anne Welch, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us on.
You're very welcome. Seth Rowland, good to talk to you. And Annalise Rubita, well, as I said before we started recording this, I knew you when you were a very tiny tot. Cool to see you as not so tiny a tot at all any longer, and a professional woodworker at that. This has been Attention Please. It's available on KPTZ Mondays at noon and 5, Saturdays at noon, and it's a podcast typically just a few moments after the first broadcast on Monday. Thank you for listening. I'm Phil Andrus.
Like a dog with